supposed to throw it for him, not the iPads. By pure coincidence, I was thinking last night, for some reason, at 12 o'clock at night, that if I would design a Beit Midrash, so I would put the seats higher and the person speaking lower. There's like in universities, they build these auditoriums where the speaker, I think it's the right way to do it. People are high and the speaker is low. When you speak from above, so either Moshe Rabbeinu, or gives me an unfair advantage. But what can we do? This is what they do. Okay, assuming that this doesn't fall down in the middle. But last week, we spoke about the topic of what's known as Yidiyah V'Bechira. Today we're going to speak about the much more important topic, which we could call Yicholet V'Bechira. Not God's foreknowledge, but the basic question of causation, source of action, and freedom. Religiously, it means God's Yicholet. And if it was asked about God, it would mean, how can you be free to do anything when everything that takes place, everything that exists, has to be a direct result of God's will. Nothing outside of God's will can exist. To exist means that God wants you to exist. Therefore, what does it mean to say that you have free will? That's the religious version of the question. But we're going to talk about, in order to get to that, we'll talk about the much more general question, which is asked in any philosophy department outside of questions of religion. And so what does it mean to say that, what could it possibly mean to say that there are uncaused actions, there are actions which are free? So we'll start from this. It's an axiom of scientific thought going back 3,000 years, not a new thing. It's an axiom of scientific thought that every effect has a cause. Every effect, meaning everything that you can describe, can be described in terms of its causes. That's the yesod of science. If that wasn't true, then there would be no scientific work being done at all. Every time you examine something, you ask why, and then you look for those factors which have to exist, which would then be satisfactory explanations for why it exists. If we could say about events, from a human being's thing, if we could say about events, why is the light shining in the room? The answer, because, kacha, then you've made it, if that's an acceptable answer, then there's no possibility of scientific thinking at all. All scientific thinking is looking at events and trying to discover what the causes must be, and therefore, then we can reproduce the causes in the future. And therefore, automatically, to the extent that, which is a historical process, scientific thinking slowly and inexorably over the years dominates all thinking, which wasn't always true, but becomes more mature as years go by, it becomes more difficult for people to think of uncaused actions. But that's merely an axiom of scientific theory. It's not something that can be proven. Right? It's an axiom of scientific thought. That's the way scientific thought works. Therefore, reputable scientific philosophers are willing to concede that it could be otherwise. That's the question here. Are there events, namely human decisions, which cannot be described in terms of pre-existing causes? People believe in free will, say yes. So the fact that science doesn't allow that merely means that science doesn't explore those kind of things. It's not an event which is a scientific event. However, the next line is very important. Being willing to concede that to the modern philosophic mind means that, okay, if you argue for free will, you're arguing for uncaused events. And uncaused events are seen as being absurd. Why are they absurd? What's an uncaused event? So the example I gave just now would be an uncaused event. You ask me, why is the light shining? It just is. And if it all of a sudden goes off, why did it go off? It just did. That's not a model. Now, that could be. There's no way to scientifically prove that things like that don't take place. Scientists would be very much upset if they took place that way, but you couldn't prove they don't take place. But those kind of things are meaningless. That's not what we mean by free will. By free will, we mean something else. We mean that there were certain decisions I've made where there was no pre-existent mechanical cause, but nonetheless, there was a reason why I chose. They weren't random. They weren't simply uncaused in the total sense. Uncaused, meaning without any cause whatsoever, is described by the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim as being the opinion of a Greek man whose name his parents called him Kaifer. No, they called him Epikoros. They didn't realize when they gave him that name what a good name it was, because it turned out that he was an Epikoros. Kishmo Kenu. It's always a wonderful thing when that takes place. Of course, it could be psychological, you know, when you give your kids names, sometimes they live up to the name you give them. That's why you should not call your kid Shlemiel, even though it used to be a fine name. But it's no longer a fine name. So his name was Epicurus. And Epicurus, his apicosis consisted of one thing. He claimed that sometimes, at random intervals, the atoms which are flowing through the universe shift to the right. And sometimes they shift to the left. That was considered to be apicosis in Greek, in Greece. And Rambam accepted that use of the term. Greece was a very interesting place. Can you imagine that? This was apicosis. The person was a kofer. Why? Because he thought that atoms occasionally shifted to the right. In Yehuda, in Israel, you're an apicosis because you have, you know, really meaty opinions. You think that God doesn't exist. You think that there's no Hashgacha Pratis. But for a Greek apicosis is somebody who thinks that there are events that do not have physical causes. The reason why the atoms shift to the left is because kacha. That's not a basis for what we call free will. Because that's saying, you know, that way, if I asked you, like, why did you kill that person? You'd say, I don't know. Kacha. Why did you give tzedakah? I don't know. Kacha. That's not what we use, that's not what any of us use free will for. We use free will in a moral sense, in a ethical sense. Meaning that a person has the ability and the freedom to choose between, not between left and right, not between up and down, but between good and evil. Which is a very different kind of choice. It's a choice that has a reason. It's a choice that has a logic. It's a choice that has something behind it. It's not a random occurrence. The discussion in the Middle Ages about freedom was very much heavily influenced by the parable known as Buridan's Ass. Maybe I mentioned it. Does everybody here know what Buridan's Ass is?
Yeah.
It's a donkey. Buridan was a medieval philosopher, late medieval philosopher, and he postulated the following story. A donkey is standing in front of two equal, totally equal bales of hay. There is nothing to distinguish between them. They're both the same size, they're both the same freshness, they're both the same color, they're both the same everything. They both smell the same. And Buridan then asked the following question. Do you think the donkey is going to starve to death? The answer was no. Only very stupid donkeys would starve to death because they couldn't choose between two equal bales of hay. So how is he going to choose? The answer is, he'll choose. He'll just pick one at random. But that's not the model that we're talking about when we're speaking about the fact that human beings have free will before God, before the world, to choose between good and evil, between right and wrong, between mitzvos and averus. That's not just saying that, okay, I have to choose, so I'll choose this one or that one. And a famous book written by William James, he confronted, it's a very 19th century question. In the 19th century, they invented a movement called agnosticism. Agnostics didn't exist till the 1800s. Before that, you either were an atheist or a theist. But as scientific thinking developed, so people had an idea at one point, no longer, but they one thought that you should only believe in those things which can be proven one way or another, proven logically or proven consistently. After many years of philosophy, they noticed that there are no proofs to the existence of God. There are no proofs that God doesn't exist. So therefore, there was this whole movement of educated, fine people who said, oh, I'm not going to be an atheist. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to be a theist either. I'm going to be an agnostic. Things haven't been proved. You ask me, do I think that there are little funny people living on the other side of the moon? So it would be dogma to say no. That's what people who get overly impressed by science, therefore make up things. But you know, there could be. But we have no reason to say yes or no. Therefore, I'm agnostic about that question. Right? Just like I'm agnostic about the question as to whether or not the Mashiach is going to come in the next 5 minutes. Could be. Could be no. I don't maintain an opinion about that. So William James wrote a book against agnosticism, where he said that important questions, you have the freedom to choose even without a proof. But It's not a short book. It's not one page. What I just said now is only one page. The rest of the book is describing how does one do that. There have to be reasons for that. He's not saying that I, William James, am a theist because, well, there's no proof A or B, so I said, okay, I believe in God. Why? Why not? I have the freedom to choose. He was saying that, given the fact that there is no good proof one way or another, therefore I'm not obligated, logic doesn't obligate me to accept a certain opinion, but nonetheless, I have the freedom to choose on the basis of other things, namely that it appears to me to be consistent, it adds meaning to it with my life. It's a long and interesting book, which is a little bit outdated, 110, 120 years old, but nonetheless, very influential book even today. So, in the modern world, in the modern philosophic world, basically, people don't think that the word freedom has any meaning whatsoever, because everything is science. But if it does, it's something which, you understand why it's not very appealing, it's something which science really can't recognize, namely that sometimes things just happen stam. But what religious people think of as freedom of will has no place at all in the modern thought, because they're talking about that things take place without any defining reason, but nonetheless, there's a difference between the two sides. And that there's really no way to define that in modern systems of thought. It's an interesting situation because we're living in the age of freedom. In other words, there's a huge gap between humanistic and political discourse and scientific and philosophic discourse. Depending on what room you're in, you can get up and you can say human freedom is the greatest of all values. That's in your humanities course. Philosophy is not in the humanities for this purposes. That's in your literature courses, maybe your political courses, or your courses in political activism when you have to go to protest against something. So you're willing to sacrifice your life in order to bring freedom to the suffering. I want to get something which nobody has an opinion about, the suffering Burmese, which is today called Miao Miao. But then you go to a class in physics or in the philosophy of science, or frankly any philosophy course today, and you discover that freedom doesn't exist at all. We spoke months and months and months ago, this is between naturalism and supernaturalism. Naturalism is the theory that says that everything can be described as a natural result of the arrangement of atoms in the universe. So if we can explain physics and psychology, I took two extremes, if we can explain physics on the basis of atoms. And in the end, we can explain psychology the same way because it's the atoms that are in the neurons, which are neurons are in your brain. The brain tells you what you're going to do. Then there's no place to talk about true freedom of the will. You can talk about psychological freedom of the will, the fact that people think that they're free, the fact that it's a good feeling, that maybe psychologists should encourage people to feel free, because the difference between feeling free and feeling compulsion, people who feel compulsion are generally treated by psychologists because they have OCD. You should feel free, but what you're feeling is a particular arrangement of the molecules in your brain, which is a better arrangement than, I don't know why it's better, it's a better arrangement than what these other people who feel compelled to constantly check to make sure that their buttons are buttoned. So they're operating under compulsion, you're operating freely, you can do whatever you want, meaning that you can do whatever your brains tell you to do, but without realizing that you don't have this feeling of oppression which you would otherwise have. But real freedom, what do we mean by real freedom? Why is real freedom important to us? Because, as the Rambam points out, morality, he says, chava onesh, is only possible if there's real freedom. In other words, it doesn't make a difference what you feel, but if you didn't make a genuine choice, which you didn't have to make, then there's no reason why you should get chava onesh from God, or why you should come closer to God, or why you should be a good thing. Why ethics, and forget about chava onesh, ethics itself is only possible. Chava onesh is only the proof that the Rambam uses. But ethics itself requires that my actions be genuinely free, that I chose between two possibilities. Otherwise, I mean, we don't reward, nor do we see robots as being ethical individuals, or as being worthy of ethical value or ethical admiration, since they do what they've been programmed to do. Who programs you makes no difference. If you're programmed by accident, it wouldn't be any more ethical than if you were programmed by somebody. We don't think that the fact that metal sink in water, is that good or bad? It's neither. It's not an ethical action. It's because that's what heavy metals do. They're heavier than the weight of water. And if everything has that kind of a cause, then you've eliminated the nature of ethics as totally, or in religious terms, the ability to come close to God, to reflect God, or to act like God, or to be B'Tselem Elokim, all those things are eliminated. There probably are religions which could live well with our freedom of choice. Like 50% of the Protestant world lives without freedom of choice for the last 500 years, ever since Calvin claimed that there is no freedom of choice. If you don't have a theory that says that some human beings are better than others, if you just simply say that some human beings are saved and some human beings are not, which is what Calvinism says, but you don't have genuine freedom of choice. You can have a religion, meaning it's but to look to God. But a religion which talks about achievement, a person can achieve something, he becomes closer to God, or a religion which insists on ethics, like Yiddishkeit does, is going to have a lot of problems if there is not genuine freedom of choice. The problem I've just tried to describe on one foot is a problem which everybody has, simply because we're trained for, I don't know, 50% of the time, 80% of the time, we're trained to think of not cause and effect, but effect and causes. Anything we see, we ask. And frankly, we all do that, even though we're all big believers in freedom of choice. We do that in matters of human choice as well. Somebody walks into the room and suddenly stands up. Well, let's take a Malachi. Somebody walks into the room and kills the person sitting next to him. So everybody in this room would ask, you know, why did he do that? And if I said, well, he did it because, I'll give you a theory. When he was very young, he was being toilet trained, so his parents were very, very strict. And therefore, he tends to kill people who remind him of his mother. Sounds good. I mean, you've all seen the television shows based on that premise. They're shown nightly. And we do that. I mean, all of us do that. Well, I said something less dramatic. You know, he killed him because he has a lot of frustrations in life. And, you know, he lost his job, and his wife has left him, and his kids don't admire him, and he's overweight, and he just can't handle it. And then this guy next to him, who's thin and has a job and has a wife and has children who respect him, just couldn't take it anymore, so he killed him. I mean, we ask those questions. And what would be the alternative to asking those questions? We would say, why did he kill him? Just like that. That wouldn't be a good answer either. The answer that we're looking for is neither one of those two alternatives. And it's very hard to define what that answer could be. Did he kill him because his brain was hardwired for frustrations, anger, and resentment? Or did he kill him for no reason whatsoever? Occasionally, there are television shows like that also, right? But then we give reasons for that as well. There are people who kill people for no reason whatsoever. So just think what your reaction was to that statement. There's this kid, and one day he decided to shoot somebody. So what do we all ask and answer? Why does he do things for no reason whatsoever? The answer is because, I've already ruined it. He does things for no reason whatsoever because, oh, when he was younger, so whatever, his parents, the psychologist will come up with a reason for why people do things without reason. Right? And we've been trained to work along those lines. So what does it mean then when I say this person has chosen to put on tefillin this morning, this person has chosen not to kill, this person has chosen to kill somebody, and I view that as being a momentous action which God is very interested in, and your Olam Haba is dependent on that? It's the way you were wired. Some people are wired better than others. Or something which is really hard to accept today, none of us can imagine it, the Epicurean answer: no, it just happened. It just did it. It just, the atoms just swerved right. My hand just killed you. None of us can imagine answers like that, but that science has totally taken over, and we think that everything has to have a cause. Now, some religious people will say, if they don't think of the implications, of course everything has a cause. You know, God is the ultimate cause. That's a religious version of the same, that's not a religious answer, that's a religious version of the same question. If you think that the cause of everything in the world is God, for instance, the Ramban, who explains, what does it mean? Shashem yichbid et lev paro. So the second answer of the Ramban is, chas v'shalom, God did not take away Paro's free will. But everything that takes place in the world is ultimately dependent on God, so God is the cause of Paro's free choice. But if that's not a religious answer, that's a religious question. If you think that nothing can take place in the world unless God is behind it, and God is the cause of everything, and therefore God is the cause of free will, then what's left of the freedom of free will? If If I bang the table and it breaks, could the table break if God didn't want it to break? I presume the answer is no. Nothing takes place without God being behind it. How about, can I move my hand without God being behind it? I presume the answer is no. It requires an act of Bria Yesh Me'ayin for my hand to move. It's a physical law. Physical laws are controlled by God. Okay, but why does my hand move? My hand moves because I decided to make my hand move. Why is that different? Why did I, could I make a decision if God was not supporting my decision? Doesn't God stand behind? Isn't God the cause of my decisions? Oh, the cause of my decisions, you no longer have freedom. Okay, so I'm going to try to explain why the problem is not correct. But I'm saying in advance, the problem is not correct because of a basic difference in concept, not of free will, but of everything. Free will is just another example of the basic line which we talked about 4 months ago between naturalism and other things and another kind of cause, another kind of thing that's not a natural, meaning a mechanical cause. We have a system of cause and effect which includes everything, as far as we know, in the physical scientific universe. But there are things which are outside the system. That was one of the ways I proved God 4 months ago. Is there something outside the system? Now, one of the proofs I mentioned, fourth or the fifth, I don't remember exactly, was Kant's proof, was called the ethical proof of God. Ethics is something which is outside the system. That is, it affects the system does not affect it. Okay? Now, what is free will consist of? To say that there are uncaused actions is not the answer. We're not interested in uncaused actions. So, acts of free will are caused, but they're not caused mechanically. The fallacy in the way the problem is approached in most modern Western approaches is that it's a dilemma between caused and uncaused actions. But causes, we think we have down pat. Causes are scientific causes, meaning mechanical causes. If A, then B. Because something exists, that creates a chain reaction which leads to something else. Amazingly enough, Aristotle, who lived 3,000 years ago, thought there were other causes other than mechanical causes. For instance, he thought that there were teleological causes. There were what he called final causes. Nobody in the modern world thinks there are final causes anymore. So I'm going to suggest that we should adopt we're going to use Aristotle to save Yiddishkeit. I'm suggesting that we adopt Aristotle's sense. What's a teleological cause? The Greeks, naturally, without believing in God necessarily, it didn't involve God, thought that if you asked, why does this table exist? So Aristotle said there were four causes. One is the material cause, the stuff out of which it's made. Two is the formal cause, the shape of a table. Three is the efficient cause, meaning the person who, what do you call it, Nagar? Carpenter, thank you. The carpenter who made the table. And fourth is the teleological cause, meaning for what does it exist? The cause of the table is in order to put iPods on the table, or my elbows on the table. I can never tell with you guys. Aristotle didn't give that answer. Okay. I know, sometimes I met a fellow last year in the yeshiva who asked me, who was schmoozing, you know, so he asked me, he heard a rumor that the Lichtenstein doesn't use a computer. I told him it's true. He said he doesn't understand. He wrote a doctorate. That's when I realized that people of a certain education and age cannot imagine a world without, how can you write a doctorate without a computer? You know, so I said to him, he typed it. Okay, so that's why Aristotle did not say, we said the same thing. He said the table exists in order to put on craters of wine and fresh olives. But that's not just saying, oh, that's true. That's called, in Aristotelian terms, that's called the cause. If that wasn't true, if that need did not exist, the table would not exist. Okay, so Aristotle said that most things have four causes. Some things have less. Some things have only this or only that. The area that we're talking about, you cannot divorce the question of free will from the question of ethics. We're not interested, nor do I have a theory to explain how people have free will in questions of, should I eat eggs for breakfast or cheese for breakfast? unless your decision is based on some sort of an ethical decision, like cholesterol or something like that. But if you have, no, it's all the same to me, but I want to decide, I have to choose what I eat, sometimes I eat, sometimes I eat that. That's not a question of free will. There, I'm perfectly willing, and I think it sounds correct to me, that the psychologists and the psychiatrists and the evolutionary biologists are correct. The reason why you choose to eat eggs in the morning is because you're hardwired to like round things. And the other guy likes to eat cheese because yellow is his favorite color. That's going to be the reason, one way or another. No problem with that at all. We are talking about free will in the realm of ethics. Ethical decisions have a cause. They're not uncaused. They're caused by the good. The good is not an efficient cause. It's not a material cause. It's not a pre-existent cause. It's not that the good pushes me to do things. The good is that which I'm trying to achieve. That's also a cause. It's not that there's no difference between the two things, which would make no sense. But the area that's called ethics is an area which doesn't exist under scientific rules. It's a non-natural. Ethics is the good is a non-natural thing. You have to realize, I mean, we've been doing this almost the entire year. How many of these questions are intertwined? You know, which is why I on purpose used 4 months ago the word supernatural. Because the word supernatural, if you use it in polite conversation when you go to university, people will laugh at you. And that's why, but okay, yeah, that's, so don't use the word, but that's what we mean. Supernatural means non-natural and also above the natural. The whole reason why the word supernatural is a funny word today is because people have accepted, whether they know it or not, people go to church, people go to shul, have accepted that there are no supernatural entities. I mean, when they daven, they think that there is. They say there's God, but when they walk out of the shul, they no longer believe in them. Because science explains everything. But ethics and the good, and therefore free will, is the response to, it's a cause, but it's caused by a non-natural entity. It's caused by the existence of the good. And the good operates the way Aristotle described, teleological causes. It's not something behind me pushing me. Nothing's pushing me in that area. It's something which is, put it this way, something which is attracting me. I choose to go in this area because that's the way I want to go. That appears to me to be the better choice. I choose the good over evil. Now that whole thing is only possible if you think such a realm exists. In other words, if you when you describe existence, you describe only natural objects, and then you say, "But I can choose between natural objects," then you're really making a mistake, and then you're going to fall in, which is, I think, the way the argument usually is made. When we learned free will in fourth grade, so that's what we were told. You know, the science teacher in the afternoon told us there were only natural objects, and then the religion teacher, the Torah teacher in the morning told us, yeah, but you can choose whether you want to eat tafis, or which is a natural object, or kosher, which is another natural object. But then it really makes no sense. There is no reason other than natural reasons to choose one natural object over another natural object. And if there are no reasons you choose nonetheless, then it's a meaningless choice, then it's a random choice, then it's a Buren and Zass choice. But once you have to accept that when you look at a piece of meat and another piece of meat, aside from being two pieces of meat, there's another quality here, which is not a scientific quality. Namely, this is good and this is bad. Those are non-scientific, non-natural qualities. When we choose, we're not choosing the flavor over this flavor. If you choose one flavor or another flavor, it's because your genes want it. Because something in your brain, something in your natural constitution wants it. But you're choosing the good over the bad, then that's a choice which is operating on a different basis, operating on the basis of not that there is something in my physical, mechanical world which is hardwired for the good, but there's something in my ethical world, which is very, not the hard word, hardwired doesn't make any sense anymore. There's something in my ethical world which doesn't force me to choose one thing over another, but is the reason why I choose one thing over another, because being an ethical person, I therefore choose ethically. All these questions, almost everything we've talked about, frankly, since the beginning of the year, are interconnected questions, which is why it's almost a cultural question. It's not a small point of philosophy. It's two cultures of how do you analyze situations in which we're facing. Now, once you realize that, then there's no logical reason why freedom of choice doesn't exist. There are scientific problems involved. In other words, scientific developments have tended to show that many of the choices we make, which we thought were ethical choices, are in fact, to put it mildly, heavily influenced by natural causes. It is true. In other words, if we could show, let's say, once it was merely a psychological theory, but today it's not a psychological theory, it's a scientifically proven partial fact. If we can show that people who were brought up in a certain environment, who were brought up in an ethical environment, or an Orthodox environment, or a Yiddish environment, or something or other, if we can show that their brains really look different than the brains of people who were brought up in the slums. So now, when I ask you to choose to learn Torah, and I ask Felipe Gonzalez from 187th Street to choose to learn Torah, we're not talking about two free decisions. It's true. That's a scientific problem. And that requires a different kind of explanation about how the two interrelate. What I'm claiming now, it's an obvious question. If I say there are two worlds, there's a natural world, which is a self-enclosed system of cause and effect, where everything in the natural world is caused by other things in the natural world. Heat causes evaporation, which causes rain, which causes etc. Then there's another world, which they're intertwined somehow, which is a non-natural or a supernatural world, in which things are not caused. The things that exist there, the non-natural qualities, are not caused by natural qualities, they're caused by non-natural qualities. But now, we're not talking multiple universes. The two things are intertwined, and therefore there is a cause and effect between them. Here's where the word supernatural comes in, and we've already defined this in the past. The relationship between them is that, in fact, it's true that the natural world cannot change the supernatural world, but the supernatural world does change the natural world. And therefore, since I, as a natural creature, when I make a decision, it's very conceivable. It's almost for sure. The idea that a person is a tabula rasa, he's a clean slate, and therefore all his decisions are equal, is absurd. It really is absurd. You don't need modern science to prove that. I'm sure Chazal knew that as well. Obviously Chazal knew that as well. But it's very impressive today, because I can show you which part of your brain, your enlarged part of which your brain, as opposed to my medium brain, is reacting when you see the following thing. It's true, I see people doing X. It doesn't elicit any physical response by me, but it does by you. Because whatever, your brain has been arranged differently. That's not an astonishing conclusion. It had to be that way. If I'm talking about two different worlds which interact, and they have to interact, and the interaction is going to be, in fact, very, very complicated. So practically speaking, there's a very simple sentence which must be said, but it's said with, you have to work at it. The sentence says that physical causes restrict our choices, but do not determine them. That's something which you have to be molded for, otherwise you're just ignoring everything we know about everything which anyone intelligent knows about life, and anything which anyone who's done any bit of psychology or psychiatry or neuroscience knows has proven is true about other things. But let's just forget about neuroscience. Let's talk about what we know about life. Do I now have a truly free choice to become a mass murderer at this moment? The answer is no. I also don't have a free choice at this particular moment now to choose to become the greatest tzaddik in the world. In order to become a great tzaddik, you have to have a well formed base for it. You need discipline. You need a greater love of good than I have. You need all sorts of things, which I don't have. So therefore, we've just shown that there's no such thing as free will. No, we've shown that you don't have equal free will for all things. If I make a prediction that no one in this room is going in the next 24 hours to kill anybody, I feel supremely confident of that prediction. Supremely meaning that, I have to be honest, it's only 99.9. But, you know, for the sake of, I can't tell you this, because if I tell you this, you'll all go out and do it, but you know, I'm willing to bet a lot of money. A lot of money that it's not going to happen. You don't have that freedom, but I think you do have the freedom to either learn tonight or battle tonight. We have freedom in a certain range. A choice that we make in a certain range shifts the window of choosing 1 centimeter to the left or to the right. Remember we spoke about Achrei HaMasim Olech HaLev. So that's what you make a choice about a certain action, so that means that the center of your gravity has moved over because you change the basis of your choices. So now the center of your gravity has changed accordingly, and therefore your next choice is not between A and B, but between A plus 1 and B plus 1. In other words, the zero has moved over slightly, very slightly. The window of opportunity is relatively small. The truth is, since there is a Gemara which says that, quoted once a year, and Rosh Hashanah, Elazar ben Dudaya, who did total tshuva in 1 second. So the answer is that, the truth is there is the 1% here. It's a graph. It's not that you can only do the next 2 inches on either side to get to anything else. There's a bell graph here. The real choices, things that I have relatively open possibilities, are very close to the center of the graph. Theoretically, but it's highly unlikely for natural reasons, it's highly unlikely, but you could theoretically one day just overturn the whole thing. Jews, as Jews, we don't really believe in that very, very much. Sudden conversions is not, you don't have a lot of stories. Aside from Elazar ben Dudaya, we don't have a lot of stories about sudden conversion. It's the meat and potatoes of the Southern Baptist Church. But we don't have stories like that. You don't tell, a person's walking in the forest and just says, wow! And he becomes a Baal Teshuva. Yeah, a few chassidic stories like that, but you have to be the Baal Shem Tov for that to happen. On your own, it almost never happened, as far as I know, in Jewish stories. It's a bell curve. So it's important to mention that since I'm claiming, why is the bell curve correct? Because it's an interaction. Theoretically meaning in truth, since we're dealing in purely moral choices, then a human being has the possibility of operating only in the moral world. In the moral world, you can do anything. But in order to do that, you have to overcome, you have to divorce yourself from the influence of all the natural causes of your life. How tall you are, how fat you are, how hungry you are, how big you are, who your parents are, etc., 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 and how much scorn or praise you'll get from things that you're going to do. And therefore, practically speaking, it's extremely difficult for a person to do that. Okay? But that's the practical question. To go back to the theoretical question. The better question I'm saying is the following, that any actual choice takes into account two different kinds of factors, not two factors, two different kinds of factors. Two factors means I have to choose whether or not the table is heavy and whether or not I've eaten enough in the morning. But there are two different kinds of factors which cannot be weighed at the same time. One is something which totally will answer the question whether or not I can pick up the table. That is, do I have enough strength? Do I have enough calories? How much does the table weigh? And you can answer that scientifically. The other question, which has nothing to do with the first question, is the moral choice between is there something here which is the cause, in a theological sense, there's something here which is so desirable to me that I will choose to do it? Or will I refrain from doing it? Your actual decision has to balance out those two things together. You can use one to overcome the other. You can allow the moral choice to just dissipate because it's just too hard physically. Or you can somehow use the moral choice to overcome whatever physical difficulties are placed. Again, I say physical difficulties are never 100%, but they do cast the bounds of what is possible. Now, one thing is missing from this. The thing that's missing from this is what I think I've just said now is something which intelligent people have often known. I wouldn't say always known, but have often known, namely that there is an ethical world, there is ethics, there are non-natural values. Anyone who's ethical believes that. Okay, I mean, there's a big philosophical argument about it, but naturally, in all human beings, they start from that point of view. We know that there is the good, and we know that the good is not based on physical factors, but it's based on intrinsic ethical factors. Okay, the question is, how does a human being, who is a human being, he's a natural creature, how does he operate in a non-natural world? And here you have a true philosophical problem for generations with a modern scientific twist. In other words, the modern scientific twist is as part of the ongoing capture of science of all areas. Science takes over all things which used to be not science. One of those areas which science is capturing very, very well is human beings. In other words, if human beings are not basically different than anything else, they're not basically different from apes, and apes are not basically different from amoebas, and amoebas are not basically different from water droplets, then you can't answer the question. Let's say, okay, I believe in the ethical universe, but what's it have to do with you? You are the sum of the same factors as the higher or the lower or the very lower apes. It's all just a matter of a little more brains here, a little more cells there, a little more cells there, etc., etc., etc. And this is what sociobiology is doing today. So there is a yisod which has to be added. So in the first yisod, I think people know it's true even when they deny it. Namely, that there is an ethical universe. There are non-natural qualities. Very few people who when they think about it, say that, you know, I don't think it exists. You have to be a very highly educated Oxford scientist with a smattering of 1 year philosophy to say so you don't think that ethics exists. But now comes an assumption which is very important in Yiddishkeit, but frankly, a lot of Yiddish people don't know about it. Namely, that a person is Nivra B'Tzelem Elokim. That a person, as opposed to a person, is essential, human beings are essentially different from all other natural creatures. Human beings are natural creatures, but aside from that, they also exist in two worlds. Apes do not exist in two worlds. Dogs do not exist in two worlds. Water droplets do not exist in two worlds. But human beings really exist in two worlds. Now, that's an axiom of religion. Before I said there's an axiom of science, here's an axiom of religion. It's not an axiom of religion that ethics exists. It's a human intelligence knows it's true. But that human beings have the ability to make ethical choices, that is an axiom of Yiddishkeit, which, by the way, is not emphasized in other religions. I don't know how they manage with free choice, but we manage with free choice because of Tzelem Elokim. The Rambam, in fact, said that is what, after he said that Tzelem Elokim is Seichel, he then said in another line that Tzelem Elokim is Bechiva Chofshit. Now, I want to explain what that means. The way you read Chazal, so sometimes, you know, Chazal will use the expression human beings are composite. It's trying to say that idea. Human beings are exactly like apes, but they also have another aspect, another nature, which is min ha'elyonim. So they're like the tachtonim, and that chayim v'meitim, the parim v'ravim, the third one, and they're like the elyonim, shomdim skufim, etc., etc., etc. Okay, so we call that tzelem elokim. We know what the word means. The way I described Tzelem Elokim 6 weeks ago was that Tzelem Elokim is the ability to surpass yourself, which is, of course, a non-natural ability. Nature, every effect is the sum of its causes. Not just it has causes, it's the sum of its causes. But a human being has the ability to be, what does it mean to surpass yourself? I can't jump higher than I can jump. Nobody, almost nobody, can jump higher than they can jump. I've seen a lot of movies, so I've seen great basketball movies where guys can jump higher than they can jump. But we know that, you know, like, let's put it this way, white men cannot jump higher than they can jump. Okay? You can't be stronger than you're strong. When I said a person can surpass himself, what did I mean by that? We meant it in the ethical realm. A person can be better than he is. A person can have more value than he has. A person can climb and become closer to God than he is. And that's not because you're growing like a tree grows, but you actually are really surpassing yourself. That's what I call Tzelem Elokim. And God, man was made B'Tzelem Elokim, meaning that man did not receive a definition in the ethical area that defines what he is. What he is Kamo Elokim. V'itam Kelohim, Yod'ei Tov Vara. It's not for nothing, that's what the Pasuk says. To be like God is Tov Vara. To know Tov Vara, to have a relationship with Tov Vara. So therefore, and this is basically what I said in the beginning, but now I'm saying in the end. Freedom of choice is not between two possibilities. Freedom of choice is the ability to create something new. I think this is what's always absent in discussions of freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is not just to choose to do good or to choose to do bad. Freedom of choice is first of all about yourself. It's the freedom to be better than you are. It's creativity. To talk about freedom without creativity will not work. It'll fall apart. If freedom just means, okay, I can choose two possibilities, then I'll ask, but how do you choose two possibilities? The reason why we have freedom is because we can choose to be other than we are. A good person chooses this. A bad person chooses that. I'm neither. I'm a Mittel Messiker Mensch. How do you say that in English? I'm a... There's no way to say it in English. I'm in between. Okay? I'm not that good. I'm not that bad. But, so I don't just choose to do the mitzvah, choose to do the aveira. I choose to be a person for whom doing the mitzvah is a caused action. I said the good causes what we do. But I choose as whether or not I am a good person who therefore does good, or I'm a bad person who does bad. You have the ability to define yourself in the moral realm. Now again, I'm saying that is an axiom of Yiddishkeit. It's an amuna. I cannot prove it. It's unprovable. It's unprovable. But there is a reason why it's unprovable. I'm saying that is not fair. Why can't I prove that you can be more than you can be? Because you're not more than you can be until you do it. In other words, if I examine you, I will not find anything in a human being that is more than that's there. I'm talking about a definition of a human which is unexaminable. Examinations are scientific processes. They examine facts. But we're examining potential. So therefore, no scientific explanation, no scientific examination, no psychiatrist, no scientist is going to discover in a human being the ability to be better than he is. It's not discoverable. I think many of us can taste it. Sometimes. Sometimes when you look at yourself, you realize that, I hope this is understood, I think everybody has the ability, sometimes we can sense that there's more there than can be seen. There's more there than can be weighed. Because you really are at Tzad Malukim. In other words, you are behoveh, a potential something else. But that's a scientific stira. You are present, the potential to be in the future. But so therefore I can't prove it, and therefore they can't disprove it, because what I'm saying is that they're not examining the right thing. They're not examining my future, they're just examining my present. But I have in the present the ability to be something else. And that is how we make moral choices. You'll find it's very easy to find in the library discussions of freedom of choice which ignore the ability for human creativity. If people cannot create Yeshem Ayin, I agree they cannot really be free. To be free is to be creative. I once mentioned this to Avi Mital years and years ago in an article I wrote about something else, but it came up, and he wanted to read the article. He said to me, I didn't realize then why he wanted to read the article. He told me that his criticism of the article was, yeah, but you don't realize, Chavedim, now I realize what he was looking for, he says, Chavedim don't value creativity either. Which is true. Only in Chiddushei Torah. But the idea of human creativity, to be able to do something new is a value which you won't find explicit in Jewish sources, and therefore doesn't exist in the Haredi world at all. They're really opposed to creativity. They find it disconcerting. The Rav used to say, Ma ani borei afata borei. The Rav liked to expand the Gemara about the lechet b'chod v'chav. The Gemara only talks about ethical values. You should be v'chum v'chanun, shvimal b'shamumim, etc. Every now and then would add other things. So one of the things he liked to add was, ma ani borei yesh me'ayin, afata borei yesh me'ayin. That's what it means, that God is creative. It's Tzad Elokim. It's the ability to create yesh me'ayin. I can't make tables yesh me'ayin, but I can make myself yesh me'ayin. Why? I don't have superhuman abilities. Not that I have certain magical abilities. I'm not talking about magic here. Magic would be to make the table do something the table can't do. There is no magic. Science rules. There is no magic. But in ethics, science doesn't exist. In ethics, there is only value. And value means creating new value. The value, I spoke about this 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, the only value that in the end really exists is the ability to make more value. Pointed out, if you stay in the same line, then there's really no value there at all. You're worth 100. What's 100 on God's scale? The only value that exists in this world is to exactly what we're describing, to move on and on. So again, there's a vicious cycle here, which if you don't, I'm not saying this to scare anybody, but if you don't agree with point A, you're not going to get to point B. Everything here is telling everything. Only if we realize that values increase and human beings can exist in the world of value, meaning they can increase themselves, is there any meaning, any ethical meaning, any value meaning to free choice? And frankly, there's no reason why anybody would be interested in free choice that doesn't have a value meaning to it. To say that we can choose between A and B where there's no difference between them is close to being meaningless. It might be true theoretically, but it's not interesting for us, and frankly, if the scientific world doesn't wish to accept that, they're quite right. Science has shown that there aren't areas in the world that are outside the scientific interest. There are no islands in which scientific law doesn't follow. Might be planets. No one thinks that they were going to find them either. We'd be very surprised, all of us, if one day the plane went down and we were on a desert island in the Pacific, and there gravity was the other way around. We'd be very, very surprised at kedekach that we would not believe it. We'd pinch ourselves until we woke up. We know that it's not going to happen. So things are not opposites of what they are here. Science rules. In what? In a self-enclosed world called the natural world. But if you have any non-natural values in your life, it could be ethics, it could be, I pointed out, one's reason, it could be God, it could be anything. If there's anything which is not part of that cycle, then there's another world. And here's the crucial line. Human beings, in one way or another, straddle the two worlds. Not that they occasionally here, occasionally there. They're in both of the two worlds at the same time, and therefore, we face the tension of being able to make ethical choices, but having them to drag along non-ethical, physical things. If I make an ethical choice not to eat, then I'm going to be hungry. I can't just choose not to eat. If I choose not to eat because I think tininess is a good thing, then but my body is going to protest. I'm going to be hungry. And hunger is a natural cause for eating. As anyone who's been hungry knows, when you're hungry, your hand automatically heads for the ringdings. It's automatic. It's a physical reaction. For those of us who have a physical addiction to food, which is anybody in this room, I assume, I hope. We excuse drug addicts. Not a lot, but we excuse them somewhat. Once a person has a real addiction, then he has no choice. You can get him off it, but he has to do it. We're all food addicts. Maybe we don't eat a lot, but we eat something. You eat once a day. That's a food addiction. You're physically addicted to food. You're physically addicted to... I'm physically addicted to Lashon Hara. I mean, we have a lot of physical addictions, you know. Everything is a physical addiction. That's true. Science is right. But everything is also, not everything, but those things which have moral basis are also moral things. Yes?
If the good is what's causing you to do something, then you really have the choice to choose between good and evil. You have the choice to choose between good and natural. You can't really choose evil.
Well, it's... I've avoided the question because I don't know the answer exactly, but in some sense, evil is an ethical quality. It's a negative ethical quality. I mean, I have to work this out exactly. But first of all, there's a great philosophic shaila among Jewish thinkers and non-Jewish thinkers as to whether evil exists or not. Right? Whether evil is just the absence of good. So if it's just the absence of good, then you're right. I'm choosing between either good or just ignoring the good. Sometimes normative Jewish philosophers claim that evil doesn't exist. Evil is the absence of good because only God exists and therefore there can't be evil. But then every now and then, we take evil much more seriously than some other philosophies. And so it doesn't exist, but it sure seems to exist. There is a Amalek, there is a, and in Kabbalah, of course, evil really exists. But I think practically speaking, I think it's not a problem to choose between good and evil because I think evil is an ethical, negative ethical quality. It's not neutral. It's not that choosing between either doing mitzvahs or not doing mitzvahs. Choosing between doing mitzvahs and doing averus. Averus are ethical qualities whose value is minus 10, not zero. So in the ethical realm, I'm making ethical choices between those things which should be chosen and those things which should be rejected. Okay, not just ignored. In Musa also, psychologically, I would not suggest to you that you should ignore evil and choose good. You should choose good and reject evil. Evil is worthy of being rejected. It's something which mandates a reaction. Okay, it's a cause of a reaction. The cause should be to run away from it. And there are people, you're right about one thing, is that most people who do evil don't choose evil. It's a mistake to think that there are no people who choose evil. There are evil people. If we can do 2 minutes of Musa, that's the range, that's the greatest tension in Musa. Is that for most people, when they sin, it's just because they were too tired to be better. They gave in, as you said, they gave in to nature. The Rambam more or less defines sin that way. Life consists of a war between the intellect, which knows the truth and therefore only chooses the truth. You can't intellectually choose something which is intellectually wrong. You can't choose that one and one is three. So your intellect always chooses that to do the good. But then there's the Yetzer. The Yetzer is my natural being, which needs to be fed, which needs to sleep, and it has tightness. And that's the war of ethics. But then every now and then you realize that is true for most people most of the time. But occasionally, and I think the Torah has the Muya, that's between Yishmael and Esav. Yishmael is a bum, you know, he likes to steal, he needs money. Esav is, he's a twin, a reflective, he's the evil twin of, I don't know what movie I'm quoting now. But, you know, there was an accident in the nuclear reactor and they came out good guy and negative good guy. That's why he's a twin of Yaakov. Esav is really evil. He chooses to evil, not because he makes money from it, but he has a dedication to evil. He's signed on to the evil empire. And Chazal have an opinion that evil really exists. But most of us, you know, nobody in this room is evil. You're just not as good as you could be. So then you're right. But in principle, I don't think necessarily it doesn't describe the whole choice. Occasionally, you will in fact choose between good and evil. It will happen to anybody. You know, it doesn't happen when you get up in the morning and you go and you learn a little bit, you don't learn a little bit, you eat a little bit more, you eat a bit less, but say that's not really the consideration. They're just trying to be better than you are. But in certain special situations, anybody might have a situation where you know it's evil and you know why you want it, and you ignore the message. You choose to ignore. Not that you ignore. You don't miss the message. You choose to ignore the message that says do the good, because you choose to do evil, and you make that choice. Once you make that choice, you're really in hot water. There's a when you read books, books that are written about average people are true but boring. Books that are written about great people, whether good great or evil great, are much more interesting books. Who would you prefer to have as your neighbor? To some extent, we admire greatly evil people. At least they made a choice. They're not just leaves in the wind. I would say an argument with Avital about this. Avital used to say that, you know, today there aren't any real apikosim. Oh, in the old days, when he came to Israel in the 40s and the 50s, so you can meet people who were serious kofir, who was like, you know, he said it with a great deal of admiration. Least, you know, they were serious about the kofir. Today, what do you have? People who like to make money and have no time to do mitzvahs because they're chasing hedonism. Only hedonists left. Hedonists aren't evil. But one time they were like, you know, founders of the Israeli society, they were really evil, and he said it with such a geschmack feeling. So you know, so I said, you know, I also understand that, but you know, in terms of God's goal in life, from real evil, very few people turn out to be good, but from nothing, people can grow. So I prefer having all these children running around chasing their own shadows and trying to get more ice cream. Eventually, they're going to tire of that, and then they'll discover God. But the people have a real ideology, and they're convinced that the way to make the world the way they want it is to destroy as much as possible. There's not much you can do with it, you know. But there are people like that, you know, the Pol Pots of the world, or the people who really want to. They're committed to destroying. They're committed to destruction. It does exist, and a little bit exists probably in every person, and we'll have some not community. If there wasn't any real evil, I'm not sure we would even have an argument about anything else. Only because real evil exists in some sense, do I have a choice between being better or being somewhat less better. If it was only good in the world, then we're surely intelligent enough to chase it. The reason why you don't do it is because, at least theoretically, you have something else which could attract you, and then you might not pay attention to that, but it allows you to be sleepy and lazy and indolent and not creative, and just accept what you are for what you are. In other words, it allows you, as you pointed out, to just subject myself to being a natural object. You're absolutely right that 99% of the time the things we do are because we allow ourselves to be merely natural objects. Which, by the way, isn't only true for Aveiros. It's, as I said before, it's probably true for many of our mitzvahs. You know, you do mitzvahs out of what's habit. Habitual mitzvahs, habit is a natural thing. They've been proven it already, right? Habits are causeways in the brain. There are studies which prove it. You know, that's what you can do without thinking, because it's just operating. Every time you see the sign, you get hungry. When you get hungry, you drink a Coke. People invested several billion dollars to reprogram your mind, and it works, which is why Coca-Cola is the real thing. We always thought that God was the real thing. But now we know that our brains think that Coca-Cola is the real thing because we've been programmed. So most of the time we do things out of habit. I put on tefillin out of habit. I even learn out of habit. If you're very tired and you still learn a little bit, then you've made a choice. Which is why what I described a couple of weeks ago, which is why Kashbrochu said you nisyonos. Kashbrochu is always prompting you to move up, because once you're on the plateau and you stay there, there isn't, I don't want to say nothing. I always get upset when I know the Rav Dessler said that there's no value whatsoever to being a good person on a flat plateau. I think he exaggerated. Yeah, but he's right. In other words, the real value in life is not to stay where you are. And most of the time, that's all we're doing. We made a choice 2 weeks ago. Since then, we're exploring that choice. We're having the choice to just flow on. It could be a good choice, it could be a bad choice. 100% you're right. Your choice first and foremost is to shake up the natural world and make a moral choice. But then your moral choice has to be a right moral choice. And then you're choosing between not one possibility, but very often between two possibilities. If you have to choose, I have to know whether to go, I have a situation in my life, choose what to do. Should I keep doing the same thing, or should I change my life and go to yeshiva in Israel? But my question is, someone is sick, someone is this, I have to choose, do I prioritize this or I prioritize that? It's not a matter of habit. You really know that you're at a crossroads. And you have to figure out which is the right, which is the wrong decision, and then choose the right decision. That's a choice, not between the natural world and the moral world, but between two moral choices. Yeah?
So is doing a habitual mitzvah
an ethical
good thing?
I'm saying, Rav Dessler has this line that he says that it's worth zero. If you're brought up frum and you're frum the way you were brought up, he says it's not worth a penny. You have to realize where Dessler comes from. He comes from Musa is Musa, but even in Musa there's more demanding and less demanding. Dessler came out of Kelm. Kelm doesn't exist anymore because it was too demanding. In Kelm they didn't play around with things. The suburb of Kelm insists that every morning you get up and you say, the world is falling apart, I'm gonna rebuild it. Otherwise, you're just coasting. Coasting doesn't count. I like that. I really think it's true. I just think, it's us in a saying. Or maybe it's not as true as he would like it. He probably didn't mean it either. He said it one time. I don't know. I didn't read the whole book. I read that line because I knew it was there. I assume he takes it back to some other places in some sense. So there's value in training yourself to do things naturally. But as I said once in the past, if you really stop moving, so the vote of the Baal Shem Tov is right. Once you stop moving altogether, you're dead as a stone. Then you're dead. Life consists of growing, not of being good. Stones are also good. It's not the way to grow. If I take a rock and I use it and I put it to hold my sefer down, it's a good stone. He's doing a mitzvah. He's holding my sefer down so it doesn't blow away in the wind. He does it for the next 7,000 years. But he's a rock. He's dead. Doesn't count.
So the only reason you shouldn't stop doing something once you've started is that you don't move backwards.
If you don't go forward, you go. The Musa Nukim said, if you don't go forward, you go backwards. I said, if you don't go forward, you stay still. Stay still is also bad. But the Muslim said, the sub-psychological apparatus that makes that true, that if you don't keep climbing, so apparently you're on a treadmill. And if you don't keep moving forward, then you slowly sink down. I think psychologists say that also sometimes, depending on their mood, depending on whether they will end in a Muslim yeshiva or not. Good psychologists learn in Muslim yeshivas. Like Eric Fromm. And then a Yekashi yeshiva, but they had some Muslim in it. Yeah. Yes.
So if there is a supernatural part of the human being that's attracted to good, what is it that causes us to act on the attraction to good and make ethical choices, or not act on the attraction and not make ethical choices?
It's a closed equation. It's a closed equation. The nature of ethical cause is different than the nature of physical cause. The difference is and which direction you're looking at it. There's the difference between a precedent and a goal. Ethical causes are causes. You have to realize you're not programmed to think this way. It's been several hundred years since people thought this way, since the death of Greek philosophy. But nonetheless, I think it's true. Ethical causes are not efficient causes. They're not causes in the way we normally speak. They're not causes like steam engines are causes of something. They're not causes the way my fist is a cause for the table to break. They're causes in that they hold out something to go to. And non-ethical people or non-ethical objects, it doesn't make any sense to them. It doesn't affect them. The fact that something is better or worse does in no way affect the atoms in the table. Atoms do not operate unless there's something secret, mystical going on that I don't know about, which might be, but we know, I'm willing to concede that it's not true. The physical universe is not ethical. It makes no difference to them whether or not, when you light a match, famous statement in the Middle Ages, when you light a match, it's irrelevant to the match whether you burn a tzaddik or a rasha. They're both made out of the same materials, they burn the same way. They burn the same rate, right? Because matches are not ethical. But to me, it is a difference whether or not I shoot a tzaddik or I shoot a rasha. Not because somehow the bullets or the things which push my arm, the nerves in my body react to tzaddikim differently than Mishayim. It might, but that's already psychology. It could be that I've been trained that I see tzaddikim, I go, and I see Mishayim, I go, I say something bad, but that's already a natural cause. But when I make an ethical choice, it's not that my nerves are being stimulated by tzaddikim. What's stimulating me is the future. Knowing that if I kill him, he'll die, and if I kill him, the world will be a better place. That is stimulating me, not in the sense of scientific cause, but in the sense of future cause, the sense of theological cause. So that's a very different meaning to the word cause. And how does it operate? It doesn't. The word stimulate is the wrong word. It doesn't stimulate me the way a needle makes me jump. Right? I jump when I choose to maximize a given goal. I have the choice as to what my goals are going to be.
Some people make one choice and then make another choice. If they weren't created that way, which they're not, otherwise they couldn't be held responsible for their actions.
Some people make one choice, some people make the other choice because they chose to make the choice. That's what we're trying to describe. There are these choices are not caused. When you said what makes them make the choice, you want to know what in their early childhood or what in their past has programmed them for this direction. And we're answering nothing necessarily. In other words, we'll divorce those causes. We're going to restrict those causes. It could very well be, hopefully it will be, that nothing in their past is different. Two people of the same past can make two different choices now because they are reflecting, they're looking, they're choosing to look at what's in front of them in a different manner. I choose to look at the good and say, I wish to be a better person. And therefore you can say, how is it, what makes it possible for me to jump higher than I can jump? It's a bad question if you're saying, well, you know, like, what secret medicine did you take? What secret muscles did you use? What secret shoes, whose endorsed shoes did you buy? The answer is, I can jump higher than you because I want to jump higher than you, which is what you have to, you know, because of the influence of Christianity on football coaches. So therefore, you all heard the line that says that you can jump higher than you can jump if you want to jump higher. That's what happened there was an illegitimate, in my opinion, unless again you're a mystic and you believe in these things, but that's an illegitimate carryover of religion, of ethics into the physical universe. So no one claims that that's true for medals. But somehow in sports, that's become a great mantra because football coaches in the United States are all Southern Baptists. So therefore, there's this line which, you know, you've all heard that, you know, if you only want to be a better basketball player, you can be a better basketball player. You can actually hit that shot, you just have to concentrate a little bit more. I've been trying for years. Doesn't work. At least, again, not for white people. Yeah, at least not for Jews. White Jews can't jump. That's, I don't know about white men, but white Jews cannot jump. So forgetting that line, there is nothing which makes me choose that or that. Don't look in the person's background. You could look in the person's background, you'll find things. But we're getting rid of those things. In the end, there is nothing in his background which makes him choose good or choose bad, other than the fact that he's a good person and he's a bad person. But why is he a good person or a bad person? Person chooses what he wants to be. It's not random. It's caused by my choice of relationship. Again, if I have to choose between a black iPod or a white iPod, the choice would be random. But to choose between good and evil, there is a difference between good and evil. And therefore, there's a real difference in the ethical world, and therefore an ethical choice distinguishes between them and chooses the right answer. Those who don't choose the right answer have chosen to choose the wrong answer. It's not random. One person has chosen rightly, one person has chosen wrongly. There's a value in the choice. And if you don't believe in values, then you can't make a value choice. But if you believe that values exist, then in the world of values, choices are free. All the questions here, right? I'm not saying this bizzle-zill. It's a difficult thing to keep in mind. But the confusion arises because we're transferring terms from one world to another, which we do automatically because most of our lives consist of the natural world. But it's illegitimate to ask what were the preconditions which caused this person to choose A, to choose morality over immorality, if you want a moral answer. What chose the person to choose morality over immorality was the morality of the morality of the moral choice. And the person who didn't choose that way, so first of all, it could be, in many cases, it'll be the answer that the young gentleman said before, namely that they didn't choose to choose. They allowed their choice to be made by the physical makeup of their brains. And in some cases, a person will make a choice to be immoral. Why would he do that? He chooses not to be better than he is. He might even choose to be worse than he is. He says, I'm too tired to grow. I don't wish to grow anymore. I figured it out that being ethical is also painful. And not that the pain made me choose, but I choose not to be more ethical. And that happens. You can choose the easy life, not because you're programmed for it, but because you don't wish to have, you don't wish to pay the price that ethics demands of you. That's an ethical choice. Now, why does one person choose this, one person choose it that way? Because they chose. It's wrong to ask the question, why does one person, you're asking a question which is such a typical scientific question. If I have two phenomena and they're different, there must be a difference between them. Right? If this light burns out in an hour and that light burns out in 2 hours, there must be a difference in the filament or the gas or the electricity or something. There's got to be a difference in the preconditions. You're 100% right if we're talking about electric bulbs. But we're talking about moral choice. The difference between the two people was they were two different people. That's all. You choose to create and you chose not to create. It's not something which exists. It's something which doesn't exist. I'm going to repeat the final line and then we're finished. Bechira chofshit is based on creativity. Meaning, it's not based on what is. It's based on, do I choose to be more than I am? You say, how can anyone choose to be more than they am? You can only choose what you are. No, I repeat, I'm being consistent. If I'm being illogical, it's okay, but I may be illogical, but I'm being consistently illogical. Bechira chofshit is based on Tzelem Elokim, and Tzelem Elokim is based on that you can get more than there is there. You say, well, how could that be? What caused the more? No, nothing caused the more. What caused the more is a man's ability to climb higher than he is. He who chooses not to do that is just following natural law. He who chooses to do it in one direction or another, climbing towards evil, climbing towards good, most of the time climbing towards good, I hope, that's the ability that ethics allows you to choose. Physics does not allow you to choose. Ethics allows you to choose. That's the meaning of ethical choice. The meaning of ethical choice is choice. And therefore, the consistency is maintained. Okay.